Page 173. The Attack of the Glowworm Dragon Korgon. Pages 173 through 194. Page 174 is blank. Page 175. Now with the fall of darkness, the mist crept down from the hills, slinking as fingers around the trees, seeping over the green fields toward the Hall of Hurot and the waiting warriors of Buluwif. Here there was a respite in work. From a fresh spring, water was diverted to fill the shallow ditch, and then I understood the sense of the plan, for the water concealed the stakes and deeper holes, and thus the moat was treacherous to any invader. Further still, the women of Hrothgar carried goatskin sacks of water from the well, and doused the fence and the dwelling, and all the surface of the Hall of Hurot with water. So also the warriors of Buluwif drenched themselves in their armor with water from the spring. The night was damp cold, and thinking this some heathen ritual, I begged excuses, but to no end. Hergr doused me head to foot like the rest. Page 176. I stood dripping and shivering. In truth, I cried aloud at the shock of the cold water and demanded to know the reason. "The glowworm dragon breathes fire," Hergr said to me. Then he offered me a cup of mead to ease the chill, and I drank this cup of mead without a pause and was glad for it. Now the night was fully black, and the warriors of Buluwif awaited the coming of the dragon Korgon. All eyes were turned toward the hills, now lost in the mist of night. Buluwif himself strode the length of the fortifications, carrying his great sword Runding, speaking low words of encouragement to his warriors. All waited quietly, save one, the lieutenant Ekthgau. This Ekthgau is a master of the hand axe. He had set up a sturdy post of wood some distance from him, and he practiced the throw of his hand axe to this wooden post over and again. Indeed, many hand axes had been given him. I counted five or six clipped to his broad belt, and others in his hands and scattered on the ground about him. In like manner was Hergr stringing and testing with his bow and arrow, and also Skeld, for these were the most skilled in marksmanship of the Northmen warriors. Page 177. The Northmen arrows have iron points and are most excellently constructed with shafts straight as a taut line. They have within each village or camp a man who is often crippled or lame, and he is known as the almsman. He fashions the arrows and also the bows for the warriors of the region, and for these alms is paid with gold or shells, or, as I have myself seen, with food and meat. Footnote 1. The bows of the Northmen are near the length of their own bodies and made of birch. The fashion of shooting is this. The arrow shaft is drawn back to the ear, not to the eye, and thence let fly, and the power is such that this shaft may pass cleanly through the body of a man and not lodge therein. So also may the shaft penetrate a sheet of wood of the thickness of a man's fist. Verily, I have seen such power with an arrow with my own eyes, and I myself tried to wield one of their bows, but discovered it ungainly, for it was too large and resistant to me. Footnote. Footnote 1 on page 177. This passage is apparently the source of the 1869 comment by the scholarly Reverend Noel Harley that among the barbaric Vikings, morality was so perversely inverted that their sense of alms was the dues paid to weapons makers. Harley's Victorian assurance exceeded his linguistic knowledge. The Norse word alm means elm, the resilient wood from which the Scandinavians made bows and arrows. It is only by chance that this word also has an English meaning. The English alms, meaning charitable donations, is usually thought to derive from the Greek ilios, to pity. Return to text. Page 178. These Northmen are skilled in all the manners of warfare and killing with the several weapons that they prize. They speak of the lines of warfare, which has no sense of arrangements of soldiers, for all to them is the combat of one man to another who is his enemy. The two lines of warfare differ as to the weapon, for the broadsword, which is always swung in an arc and never employed in stabbing, they say, the sword seeks the breath line, which means to them the neck, and thereby the cutting off of the head from the body. For the spear, the arrow, the hand axe, the dagger, and the other tools of stabbing, they say, these weapons seek the fat line. Footnote 2. Footnote 2. Linea adeps, literally fat line. Although the anatomical wisdom of the passage has never been questioned by soldiers in the thousand years since, for the midline of the body is where the most vital nerves and vessels are all found, the precise derivation of the term has been mysterious. In this regard, it is interesting to note that one of the Icelandic sagas mentions a wounded warrior in 1030 who pulls an arrow from his chest and sees bits of flesh attached to the point. He then says that he still has fat around his heart. Most scholars agree that this is an ironic comment from a warrior who knows that he has been mortally wounded, and this makes good anatomical sense. In 1847, the American historian Robert Miller referred to this passage of Ibn Fadlan when he said, "Although ferocious warriors, the Vikings had a poor knowledge of physiognomy. Their men were instructed to seek out the vertical midline of the opponent's body, but in doing so, of course, they would miss the heart, positioned as it is in the left chest." The poor knowledge must be attributed to Miller and not the Vikings. For the last several hundred years, ordinary Western men had believed the heart to be located in the left chest. Americans put their hands over their hearts when they pledge allegiance to the flag. We have a strong folk tradition of soldiers being saved from death by a Bible carried in the breast pocket that stops the fatal bullet, and so on. In fact, the heart is a midline structure that extends to varying degrees into the left chest, but a midline wound in the chest will always pierce the heart. Return to text. Page 179. By these words, they intend to center part of the body from head to groin. A wound in this center line means to them certain death to their opponent. Also, they believe it is foremost to strike the belly for its softness than to strike the chest or head portion. Verily, Bulwiwf and all his company kept watchful vigil that night, and I among them. I experienced much fatigue in this alertness, and soon enough was tired as if I had fought a battle, yet none had occurred. The Northmen were not fatigued, but ready at any moment. It is true that they are the most vigilant persons on the face of all the world, ever prepared for any battle or danger, and they find nothing tiresome in this posture, which for them is ordinary from birth. Page 180. At all times are they prudent and watchful. After a time I slept, and Herger woke me thus and brusquely. I felt a great thumping and a whistle of air near my head, and upon the opening of my eyes saw an arrow shivering in the wood at the breadth of a hair from my nose. This arrow Herger had shot, and he and all the others laughed mightily at my discomfiture. To me, he said, "If you sleep, you will miss the battle." I said in response that that would be no hardship according to my own way of thinking. Now Herger retrieved his arrow and, observing that I was offended with his prank, sat alongside me and spoke in a manner of friendliness. Herger this night was in a pronounced mood of joking and fun. He shared with me a cup of mead and spoke thus, "Skeld is bewitched." At this he laughed. Skeld was not far off, and Herger spoke loudly, so I recognized that Skeld was to overhear us. Yet Herger spoke in Latin, unintelligible to Skeld, so perhaps there was some other reason I do not know. Skeld in this time sharpened the points of his arrows and awaited the battle. To Herger I said, "How is he bewitched?" In reply, Herger said, "If he is not bewitched, he may be turning Arab, for he washes his undergarments and also his body each day." Page 181. "Have you not observed this for yourself?" I answered that I had not. Herger, laughing much, said, "Skeld does this for such and such a freeborn woman who has captured his fancy. For her he washes each day and acts a delicate, timid fool. Have you not observed this?" Again I answered that I had not. To this Herger spoke, "What do you see instead?" and laughed much at his own wit, which I did not share or even pretend, for I was not of a mood to laugh. Now Herger says, "You Arabs are too dour. You grumble all the while. Nothing is laughable to your eyes." Here I said that he spoke wrongly. He challenged me to speak a humorous story, and I told him of the sermon of the famous preacher. You know this well. A famous preacher stands in the pulpit of the mosque, and from all around men and women have gathered to hear his noble words. A man, Hamid, puts on a robe and veil and sits among the women. The famous preacher says, "According to Islam, it is desirable that one should not let his or her pubic hair grow too long." A person asks, "How long is too long, O preacher?" All know this story. It is a rude joke indeed. Page 182. The preacher replies, "It should not be longer than a barley." Now Hamid asks the woman next to him, "Sister, please check to tell me if my pubic hair is longer than a barley." The woman reaches under Hamid's robes to feel the pubic hair, whereupon her hand touches his organ. In her surprise, she utters a cry. The preacher hears this and is much pleased. To the audience, he says, "You should all learn the art of attending a sermon as this lady does, for you can see how it touched her heart." And the woman, still shocked, makes this reply, "It didn't touch my heart, O preacher, it touched my hand." Herger listened to all my words with a flat countenance. Never did he laugh or even smile. At my conclusion, he said, "What is a preacher?" To this, I said he was a stupid Northman who knew nothing of the wideness of the world. And to this he laughed, whereas he did not laugh at the fable. Now Skeld gave a shout, and all the warriors of Bullywoof, myself among them, turned to look at the hills behind the blanket of mist. Here is what I saw. High in the air, a glowing fiery point of light like a blazing star, and a distance off. All the warriors saw it, and there was murmuring and exclamation among them. Page 183. Soon appeared a second point of light, and yet another, and then another. I counted past a dozen, and then ceased to count further. These glowing fire points appeared in a line which undulated like a snake, or verily like the undulating body of a dragon. "Be ready now," Herger said to me, and also the Northman, saying, "Luck in battle." This wish I repeated back to him in the same words, and he moved away. The glowing fire points were still distant, yet they came closer. Now I heard a sound which I took as thunder. This was a deep, distant rumbling that swelled in the misty air, as all sounds do in mist. For verily it is true that in mist a man's whisper can be heard 100 paces distant, clear as if he whispered in your own ear. Now I watched and listened, and all the warriors of Bulawif gripped their weapons and watched and listened likewise, and the glowworm dragon of Korgon bore down upon us in thunder and flame. Each blazing point grew larger, and baleful red, flickering and licking. The body of the dragon was long and shimmering, a vision most fierce of aspect, and yet I was not afraid, for I determined now that these were horsemen with torches, and this proved true.